I think probably most people here expected me to talk about stripes, but since this is an overview talk and our current view of stripes is changing every week, it didn't seem quite appropriate. So instead I'm looking at really a sort of classical Elbit quantum in this case problem, which is the two-dimensional Heisenberg model, which is, I think, a sort of model system quantum magnetic problem which has been worked on intensively throughout the last 10 years, and which I think a really elegant picture has emerged. I want to tell you about it. Then in addition, besides the pure 2D Heisenberg model, then it turns out, essentially by luck, it wasn't us but some others, but then we rediscovered a material which combines the physics of the two-dimensional Heisenberg model with the physics of frustration in, I think, a particularly elegant way, and as you will see, it really provides a beautiful illustration of the quote-unquote Schender mechanism. Schender's here, actually, to my pleasure, and he wrote a very elegant and beautiful and far-sighted paper in 1982, which turns out to appear in these 2D quantum magnets in a very manifest itself in a very elegant and beautiful way. So, we and a large number of other people have been working on the two-dimensional Heisenberg model. It really seems forever, actually. And here I just list the people who have been involved in the most recent experiments. Rebecca Christensen, Yasuo Endo. Rebecca's a student of mine at MIT. Yasuo Endo, Roth Irwin at NIF, Martin Graven, who unfortunately because of death in his family can't be here, but at Stanford, Mark Kastner at MIT. Young Lee, a student of mine just completing his PhD at MIT. Bob Lahaney, a postdoc at MIT. Ken Chirani, Barry Wells, who's now at University of Connecticut, and Kazu Yamada. See, with all of those people, this has been a sort of major effort. Missing from the list prominently, actually, is because I listed only recent people, is Bernhard Keimer, who played a very important role in the earlier experiments. Our work on the 2D Heisenberg model with frustration involves Avdon Aharoni, who's here, Fong Chu, student of Dave Johnson's, who's now at MIT, again Roth Irwin at NIST, Ora Enta-Wolman, who's also here from Tel Aviv, again Martin Graven, Brooks Harris from Penn. You'll recognize the theorists because the theory turns out to be very sophisticated and very elegant in the materials I'll show you later. Again, Mark Kastner from MIT, my longtime collaborator. Youngjoon Kim, who's actually a neutron scattering experimentalist, but earlier on in this conference you saw some beautiful quantum Monte Carlo results of his on the quantum spin chain, which got shown earlier. He's also done some nice quantum Monte Carlo. Kornblit at Tel Aviv, the same Young Lee, and the same Gen Chirani. Okay. The really beautiful thing about quantum magnets is that the Hamiltonian is so simple. And so, I'm not sure. So this is, of course, 2D Heisenberg Hamiltonian. And here we've allowed all J's. The actual application of this is going to be, which I'm going to show you. This shows two of the materials. We're actually only going to show it in one. This is lanthanum copper oxide, which is, of course, the material that is the parent material for the lanthanum strontium copper oxide, et cetera. High temperature superconductors, and this is the whole dope, and this is the neodymium compound, which is the parent compound for the electron dope material. And so, basically, I think probably as all of you know, this field of two-dimensional magnetism has been around for a very long time, and many of us, Michael Fisher did very beautiful early theoretical work on it, and a variety of other people. We did a variety of experiments in the 70s, but in fact, during that time period, we were never able to find a system which really corresponded very well to a two-dimensional Heisenberg model, and also, it turns out we had a blind spot at that time also, which we have since cleared up, as I'll illustrate to you. And there was a resurgence in this field because of the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity, and so this sort of new pulse of work on the two-dimensional Heisenberg model really was motivated by attempts to understand the physics of high-temperature superconductance. And so it was recognized very early on and initially emphasized most strongly, I think, by Phil Anderson, that the high-temperature superconductor parent materials had sheets of copper oxide which were relatively well isolated from each other. And we learned very quickly that actually these systems correspond remarkably closely to ideal two-dimensional Heisenberg magnets, with the deviations from the Heisenberg symmetry being, you know, parts in 10 to the minus 4. And so it turns out in these materials that you can probe ideal spin a half 2D Heisenberg model behavior over a very wide range of correlation lengths and reduced temperatures. So they end up making very beautiful model systems. Let me just comment in the lanthanum copper oxide system, just to make it quantitative, that first of all, the nearest neighbor J is extremely large. It's about 1300 Kelvin. And the next nearest neighbor interaction between these two spins is about an order of magnitude smaller. It's about 8% of the nearest neighbors, and it's competing. But as you saw from the many beautiful talks in this conference up to this point, an 8% interaction is not enough to alter the physics in any way. And so we will be able to get away that as a competing next nearest neighbor interaction at the 8% level puts us right near the nearest neighbor limit in terms of the phase diagram. And so we will be able to get away with a theory that is nearest neighbor only. Okay. So, right. So, actually, I'm not going to show the first experiments which were done, first precise experiments which were done in the system, which were actually done on a material by the name of strontium, copper, oxygen, chloride, but instead show you the actual paramaterial, lanthanum, copper oxide. So, the essence, it's a very straightforward experiment. You get a crystal of lanthanum, copper oxide. The particular crystal we used in this most recent set of measurements was actually grown by Bernhard Kaimer while he was a graduate student. A huge and beautiful crystal. Probably many of you know that in the first few years of research on this material, it took several years before we learned how to actually make it stoichiometric, and that all of the early experiments were done on crystals that were slightly oxygen, slightly whole doped due to excess oxygen. And so one of Bernhard's accomplishments, among many, was to figure out how to make a crystal of lanthanum copper oxide that was stoichiometric and therefore, you know, really corresponded to the ideal 2D limit. So the experiment's then very straightforward. Basically, all you do is you scatter neutrons from the material. You verify that you have a rod of scattering, which means that it's ideal two-dimensional. And then you make sure you arrange the experiment in such a way that you integrate over energy properly, so you're really measuring the instantaneous spin correlation function. Then you fit the profiles of which these are representative to. It turns out a Lorentzian describes them very well. None of these experiments are precise enough, Michael, to see the subtle deviations you predicted many years ago. So Lorentzians describe the data quite well, and from the width of the Lorentzian, you can extract the spin correlation length. And so thereby, then, the whole group of us listed on the first view graph, then we're able to extract the correlation length as a function of temperature, and you can already see, this is the spin a half two-dimensional Heisenberg model, and you can already see that the behavior, rather than looking like one of the many power laws which Michael Fisher just showed us in the previous talk, has a very different form, and in fact it looks approximately exponential, which will not surprise you. Okay, so I'll come back to the theory in a minute. So, of course, the Heisenberg model itself is not quote-unquote solved satisfactorily, the quantum Heisenberg model, but in fact with a very beautiful theoretical insight, first Haldane, but I'm not certain about that, it was realized that the low-energy, long-wavelength properties of the Heisenberg model should be identical to those of the quantum nonlinear sigma model. And so a large amount of theory was done exploiting this, and explicitly it was realized that you could map the Heisenberg model into the quantum nonlinear sigma model by relating, for the spin half case, the velocity c and the stiffness rho s to j, and implicitly to the spin quantum number. And these relations are actually known quite precisely, almost to three decimal places these days. This is a view graph from several years ago, and these numbers have been refined very slightly. So we know the mapping from the Heisenberg model to the quantum nonlinear sigma model, as I said, very precisely. In a really magnificent piece of work, Chakravarti, Halpern, and Nelson explored this. The phase diagram of the quantum nonlinear sigma model, and they produced this famous picture, which is by now reproduced in many textbooks, and showed that in the quantum nonlinear sigma model, suggested that there are three regimes. There's a renormalized classical regime, there's this famous quantum critical point, which we've seen ubiquitously in this meeting, and then if you increase the quantum fluctuations, you go into a quantum disordered state. Early on, it was suggested by a variety of people with this fancy label RVB, that the high temperature superconductors, including the parent materials, might fall in this regime. Okay, the data I showed you already proved that that's not correct, and that as Chakrabarty, Halpern, and Nelson suggested, that actually even for spin a half, with essentially nearest neighbor coupling, that we lie over in the renormalized classical part. Okay, so after we had done and published the first set of experiments, then actually I had a conversation with a particle theorist colleague of mine at MIT, who proceeded to leave MIT and go to UCSD, where he basically communicated the question I asked him to two theorists at UCSD by the name of Hasenfratz and Niermeyer, who said, yeah, we can solve that. And they then proceeded to add one more order exactly for the, well, actually to solve, in a perturbative sense, the quantum nonlinear signal model exactly at low temperatures, and they produced this expression for the correlation length for the quantum nonlinear signal model, including the first correction term. And so this is a very elegant and beautiful piece of theoretical physics. And since we know the connection between C, rho s, j, and f for the Heisenberg model quite precisely, then it meant that for the quantum nonlinear signal model, with this mapping, we could actually write down a quote-unquote exact, in a perturbative sense, expression for the correlation length of the quantum nonlinear signal model, which we could then compare with our experiments and other data. You notice there's an exponential in 1 over t in the expression, and so it's convenient, like in semiconductor physics, to express the correlation length as a function of j over t on semi-log behavior. And this is a picture which also now is appearing in textbooks, although perhaps as we'll illustrate with a discussion that will be needed to be modified in the next edition of the book. And so what you see here is that we show the experimental data on lanthanum copper oxide. Martin Graven's earlier data on strontium copper oxide and chloride. There's been extensive quantum Monte Carlo done. And first of all, just if we just compare the data in the quantum Monte Carlo, the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model, spin a half, there are no adjustable parameters. Since J is known in each of these materials from independent measurements, correlation length is measured in units of lattice constants. So this is an absolute comparison. And now we put on this quote-unquote exact low temperature result for the quantum nonlinear signal model, and that's the solid line. And so this just looks like an incredible triumph of combination of experiment and theory in two dimensions. Okay. Let me just mention also very recently there was a paper published by a group at RISO in which they looked at a sort of essentially somewhat peculiar material, copper formate tetradeuterate, which actually has fairly large deviations from the Heisenberg model. Nevertheless, even in that material, the agreement extends up to very high temperatures because in that system, J is small, so you can go up to temperatures which are higher than J. Okay. A hint that this magnificent agreement between experiment and theory might not quite be as convincing as it seems to be from the plot I just showed you came from some very beautiful quantum Monte Carlo work by a young lattice gauge theorist on our faculty by the name of Uwe Jens-Wiese. Uwe, together with a graduate student, Bernard Beard, did a combination of conventional quantum Monte Carlo and a very elegant, basically, trick in which they used the scaling function of the classical Heisenberg model and took advantage of the fact that the quantum system shows renormalized classical behavior and therefore should have the same scaling function, and therefore we're able to do a finite size scaling analysis and thereby extend the quantum Monte Carlo up to extraordinarily large length scales. And if you plot it on a normal plot, then you see they then extended our experiments up to very large, very extremely low temperatures. And if you then draw the Chakrabarty, Halpern, Nelson formula on the scale, it still looks very good. However, the Monte Carlo are precise enough that you can actually plot Uwe Jens-Wiese and Bernard Beard's results for the correlation length divided by the Chakrabarty, Halpern, Nelson formula, and then one sees actually there are subtle but systematic deviations. Now remember, the exponential is divided out here, so this is really the correction to the exponential. But it's supposed to be exact, and so if it's exact, it's exact. It has to agree, right? And what one sees is that the quote-unquote exact result agrees, but only for t over 2 pi rho s, which is relatively low, and all of the experiment is out here. And of course, the exact agreement is because the experiments, although we're very proud of them, have a precision which is at the level of about 10% or thereabouts, and never could possibly have seen these kinds of deviations. Okay, so this suggests that, you know, this magnificent agreement we had and the success of the quantum nonlinear signal model description of the spin a half Heisenberg magnet might actually have been accidental, and at least in the range in which we did our experiments. This is not actually how it occurred historically. We had already proceeded in the direction I'm about to describe, but we hadn't already realized we should do it. We would have instantly, as soon as we saw Uwe Jens' thesis picture. So the natural question to ask is, okay, so if there's now a question about spin a half, then the logical thing to do is just to look at larger spins, because this mapping into the quantum nonlinear signal model should become more precise as the spin quantum number increases. And so let's therefore just figure out how to do the experiment as a function of spin quantum number. And this then goes back into the work that we did, where we coupled closely to Michael Fisher in the early 70s. So you can just basically take the quantum nonlinear signal model expression and just generalize it to arbitrary s, and this is the form it takes. And at least from spin wave theory, which for large s ought to be reasonably precise, we then again know the relationships between c and rho s and j and s. From spin wave theory, which as I said, for large spin ought to be quite reasonable. Okay, so the generalization then of this quantum nonlinear signal result to general s is extremely straightforward, and you would have thought intuitively will become more precise as you increase the spin quantum number. Okay, that was our expectation. Okay, so how do we manage this? And so I started out by saying that all of this work has been done because recently, really as an offshoot of the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity, because the high-temperature superconductors, these systems, turn out to have remarkably small spin space anisotropies, parts in 10 to the fourth, and they're very good two-dimensional systems, and so the three-dimensional couplings are also somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 8, depending on the system. Okay. Previously, again in the late 60s and early 70s, when Gene Stanley was working on this, right, there was already known a series of fluorides as opposed to oxides, of which Rb2MnF4 is a prototype. And Rb2MnF4 is a perovskite based material, which is a simple 2D version of the three-dimensional material Michael Fisher already showed us, RbMnF3. And it had already been shown by us, among others, that this system corresponds reasonably to a Heisenberg model. If you look at the phase transition behavior, it shows the phase transition behavior of a two-dimensional Ising model. Okay. And the reason for that is that you have relatively large dipolar interactions between the spin 5 halves manganese ions. Okay, so we looked at this anyway, to at least look at the high temperature behavior. This is an experiment done by Young Lee, and this shows the correlation length as a function of temperature. I'll mention briefly the various theories. And then what you see is this dot dash line is an example of one of the theories of how it would look if it was a pure Heisenberg system. And you can see the data. This shows both our own data in Rb2MnF4 and some data by Roger Cowley on another spin 5 half material, KFeF4. And you see that when the correlation length gets up to about 10 lattice constants, that it deviates significantly from the Heisenberg model prediction, and it diverges, in a two-dimensional Ising way. And if you actually look at how large the Ising anisotropy is, and you make a hand-waving guess at what stage the correlation length squared in reduced units times the Ising anisotropy will be of the order of unity, that turns out to be just at about this stage. And Aharoni had earlier given us a prescription for the theory, how to renormalize the theory, putting in the Ising crossover, although ultimately you get a mean field transition. And so we did that, and so then you take, in essence, high temperature series expansion or related predictions, and you put in the Ising anisotropy, and it does a pretty good job of predicting the divergence. The fact that we're going to have a problem in the ultimate comparison with theory, however, is illustrated here, where the dotted line is the prediction without adjustable parameter of the quantum nonlinear signal model. And so you see in this high temperature regime, when the lengths are relatively short, even for spin 5 half, the quantum nonlinear signal model really does not work at all. Okay, and we'll proceed with it. So it actually fails in a quite major way. Okay, we have a dilemma, and the dilemma is how do we get around this Ising anisotropy? Because we really need to look at large length scales if we're going to probe the behavior of the two-dimensional Heisenberg model. And Michael Fisher, in the last talk, elegantly gave us the answer to that, which fortunately we actually remembered. Actually, I didn't remember, but Roger Kelly did and pointed it out to me. So Michael gave us this beautiful picture story about five critical points, and you may have noted that on his phase diagram for manganese fluoride, he had Ising, X, Y, and Heisenberg. Okay. And so the natural way of proceeding then, I mean, I said natural, it took us 10 years to figure out we should do this, but anyway, okay. So after some length of time then, having we mapped out the phase diagram, Roger Kelly and I, and then decided to proceed, really Bob Lahaney and Rebecca Christensen, by looking at the critical behavior along this line. Okay. And just for the aficionados here, including someone who asked Michael Doug actually at the end, in fact, technically the bicritical point is here at zero temperature. And actually these are phase boundaries which are calculated using the same kind of theory that Michael talked about. So these are the, which looks rather different in two dimensions for, you know, if it's power laws, you get exponentials, et cetera. So these are actually theoretical lines from theory done by Michael Fisher's former student, David Nelson. Okay, so by following this trajectory, therefore, we ought to be able to look at pure two-dimensional Heisenberg behavior. And indeed, the experiment worked quite successfully. And so here we show neutron scattering data, again, along this trajectory. And indeed, you can see the correlation length growing progressively as the line gets narrower. And so then here we now end up with, if you focus on the top half, with the correlation length of the two-dimensional Heisenberg model now for spin 5 halves, and getting up to length scales which exceed 100 lattice constants or in a correlated area, you have more than 10,000 spins. Okay. And so I think this is a really significant technical achievement by Rebecca Christensen and Bob Lahaney. Okay, now we need to make some comparison with theory. So first of all, the simplest comparison you can make is not with the quantum system, but you might think spin 5 halves is almost classical. So the simplest thing to do is to compare with the classical model, right? And I will remind you, at the lower temperatures, that's the functional form that the correlation length takes for the classical model, which is analogous to the renormalized classical behavior of the quantum nonlinear sigma model, except for the fact that rho classical is just J for unit vector spins, and based on some phenomenology which really originated from Rajiv Singh, we'll replace rho classical instead of by J for quantum spins by S and S plus 1. It's a natural replacement but not proven rigorously. Okay. So we do that, and so we just take the classical expression, but we just measure rho classical, just equate it to J times S and S plus 1, which is, again, the most logical thing we could think of to do, and that gives you the dot dash line without adjustable parameter. And so you see that a purely classical model describes the behavior quite well out to lengths of the order of 10. But of course it's not classical, it is quantum, and so then the simplest thing you could do after that is to do perturbation theory to put in the quantum fluctuations, and that was done by an Italian group, and they call it the purely quantum self-consistent harmonic approximation. And in their algebra, it turns out it emerges that They put in quantum fluctuations by essentially it's a temperature-dependent renormalization of the temperature scale, which it turns out if you rewrite it, it really just makes rho, the stiffness, weakly temperature-dependent, but in a way that's calculated for different S's within their theory, so there are no adjustable parameters. So it's really just classical scaling with a quantum correction. And this was done to give them credit in advance of the experiment, and there are no adjustable parameters, and the solid line with no adjustable parameters is there is the prediction for the classical, not quantum, but classical with just quantum fluctuation corrections, Heisenberg model. Okay. And the short dashed line up here is the quantum nonlinear sigma model. Okay. They also calculate the structure factor without adjustable parameters. And this is an absolute comparison. We just fix the amplitude of the susceptibility to be S and S plus 1 over 3, the high temperature limit over here. Then after that, the solid line is their calculation without adjustable parameters. Okay, so I think that's extraordinarily impressive on their part. If you go back and look at the spin a half case now and apply these various, either high temperature series expansion or again this semi-classical approach, then what you find is even for spin a half, these work reasonably well for length scales shorter than 10. I haven't extended the drawings, I should have, and then they break down drastically. Okay. And so now I'll give you a summary plot, but it now appears that this superb agreement of the quantum nonlinear sigma model for spin a half is an accident, and that, of course, it's correct up here. And if you just extrapolate the exponential, you must connect smoothly to high temperature series expansion, and it turns out that this quantum nonlinear sigma model gives the right interpolation formula between the true classical behavior at high temperatures and the true quantum behavior at low temperatures. Okay, there's no theory for this yet, I might point out. So this is a heuristic explanation on my part. Okay. These deviations from the behavior of the quantum nonlinear sigma model are shown nicely here. This is a plot constructed by Bernard Baird, and he's at Christian Brothers College in Memphis, and so my students call this a Memphis plot. So Memphis plot is just the correlation length with the divided with the quantum nonlinear sigma model low temperature prediction of Hausenfass and Niedermayer divided out the two loop prediction, and again remember that's absolute. And if we do that for spin a half, for spin one we have some experimental data, but the best data are quantum Monte Carlo, and this is by Matthias Troyer and Harada, etc. And then this is for spin five halves. This is the Hausenfass and Niedermayer result. This is for spin a half, where it never deviates very much. And so there's what we now understand to be an accidental cancellation of the higher order terms, which keep it close to the quantum nonlinear sigma value. You see for spin one, it deviates significantly over the range that people have been able to do quantum Monte Carlo. And for spin five halves, these are our experimental data. And again, the deviation is very significant. Our assumption is that asymptotically, the quantum nonlinear sigma model must work because, after all, it has the same long wavelength, low temperature properties. But it's now clear from this plot that that's only going to be true for temperature measured in units of the stiffness, let's say less than 0.1. And because of the exponential, by then the correlation length is almost macroscopic. Okay. And so you have to get to extraordinarily large length scales before you are actually in the regime where the quantum nonlinear sigma model is the correct description of the physics of the two-dimensional Heisenberg model. Okay, so this has come out very different than we thought it was going to, I have to say, several years ago, but these are the facts, and it's a sort of, I think, a nice combination of experiments and quantum Monte Carlo and theory. Okay, so that summarizes at least my view of the current situation of the two-dimensional Heisenberg model. And let's now go to the second part, which is let's now decorate the Heisenberg model with frustration. One of the nicest, from the point of view of quantum magnetism, I think one of the nicest aspects of the high temperature superconductivity problem is that it got 15 or 20 superb Japanese laboratories developing new copper oxide-based materials. And so there's been this incredible, and vanadium materials as well, but mostly copper-based materials. And so there's been just this incredible development of new materials, some of which were there already, like this one turns out to have been there already, but which no one paid any attention to because basically you had to do some sort of basic crystal chemistry and some basic characterization before you could get to the point of knowing what the structure was and what the Hamiltonian was. And so one of the offshoots of that program we heard a lot about in Daniel Chomsky's beautiful talk is copper germinate, which turns out to have really just reopened the spin pyrrhos problem completely and entirely because of the kinds of experiments you could do in that system, and that's an offshoot. And there have been a variety of others, these ladders, et cetera, right, which has been really so. High temperature superconductivity, therefore, has basically made a gift to the field of quantum magnetism, especially for experimentalists, in a way none of us could ever have anticipated. So, one of the materials, which I think is really quite a beautiful one, it's even surprising in a way that it exists, which Fong Chu in our group discovered accidentally, although then it turned out it was already in the Japanese literature. That is that it just came out parasitically when we were trying to make something else, actually. Is this material strontium 2 copper 3 oxygen 4 chloride? And this is like the strontium copper oxide, like the lanthanum copper oxide, et cetera, system, in that it has this, if you focus on the black, it has a square lattice of copper oxide, but in addition, there are these extra coppers. And so it turns out that the extra coppers sit in the center of every second plaquette. Why nature chooses to do this, I can't really tell you, but it's very, turns out to provide a beautiful physical system because it does it. So that means that we start out with exactly the same square lattice as I've just been talking about for the last half hour. And then, but in this material, then this gets, then essentially we slide in a second two-dimensional Heisenberg magnet with double the lattice constant. So we now have a physical system which has got interpenetrating two-dimensional Heisenberg magnets. And it turns out conveniently, because the lattice constant is different by a factor of two, that the energy scales are different by an order of magnitude. And so we can separate the response functions of the two different sublattices, which turns out to be extraordinarily convenient in terms of comparing, of unraveling the unusual properties of this material. It also turns out that, in fact, it's both an advantage and a disadvantage. It's very difficult to dope this material with anything. So even though it's surprising that it exists at all, it's very robust. And so, of course, we would like, actually like, as you'll guess by the end of the talk, we'd really like to disorder it. That turns out to be hard to do. Amusingly, you can't dope it at all, as far as we know, and even just putting in, you know, replacing copper by magnesium or zinc or what have you is very difficult to do, and it rejects it. So this material really likes to be pristine. Okay. So you can immediately see if we interpenetrate the copper oxide, the two-dimensional Heisenberg lattices, that we have a very interesting situation because we have this copper sitting in the exact center. And so we've heard a lot about frustration in this meeting, and so you see that this bisymmetry in an antiferromagnet is perfectly frustrated. Okay. And so what that would mean classically is that classically that these two systems would be completely decoupled, and that we should be able to study two-dimensional Heisenberg behavior in this system, and we should be able to study Heisenberg behavior in that system, and with a classical decoupling of the two systems. Okay. And it should mean that we should have two completely independent set of Goldstone bosons connected with, so I should have Goldstone modes connected with this system, and I should have Goldstone modes connected with this system. Okay. But already, Mr. Schender back here in 1982 told us that if the system's quantum rather than classical, what I just said is incorrect, and that there can in the end only be one set of Goldstone modes associated with the total system, and that's a pure quantum effect and will not happen classically. The advantage we have here, or the nice feature of this, is that by now we understand a lot about the copper oxides. And so because we understand so much about the copper oxides, and because this falls in the same family, it will mean that we will be able to make comparisons between experiment and theory that have not been possible in any previous system where this kind of frustration occurs, because they're usually complicated crystal field effects or what have you, none of which are present in this case. And so this is a very well-conditioned system for studying the effects of the so-called order from disorder phenomenon, the effects of quantum fluctuations on ordering in these kinds of systems. Okay. I might point out, by the way, that it turns out that this, except for the one copper in the middle, that the super exchange path for this copper 2 sublattice is identical to the next nearest neighbor coupling in the copper oxides. And it's expected that the exchange coupling through this copper will be very weak. And so by measuring this super exchange, we now have a precise value for the next nearest neighbor exchange coupling in the copper oxides, which is quite a useful thing to have in terms of comparisons with all of these J1, J2 models. So that's a sort of been a side benefit. Okay. You might guess that the diffraction in this material is not trivial with these interpenetrating sublattices, because we have an abundance of reciprocal lattice points. It turns out that because the extra coppers that go in the center double the lattice and rotate it by 45 degrees, that turns out to have the same symmetry. The lattice then has the same symmetry as the original copper oxide lattice. And so whereas in the lanthanum copper oxide type materials, when your square lattice orders, you get super lattice points. In this system, because the super lattice is provided by the extra copper, then it turns out that the original copper 1 lattice has the same symmetry as the nuclear lattice. Okay. So there are some, so you don't get new reciprocal lattice positions when the copper 1's order. However, when the copper 2's order, right, antiferromagnetically, they then double this already doubled unit cell, and you get a proliferation of new reciprocal lattice points. Okay. The fact that these occur at different points in reciprocal space is extremely convenient, because it enables us to separate out response function that's predominantly from one sublattice compared to the response function that's predominantly from the other sublattice. Okay. So this is actually the thesis work of Young-Joon Kim, who was a graduate student at Harvard but worked in my group at MIT. And these are actually a few graphs he showed to David Nelson and Peter Prashan just a very short time ago. Okay. Okay, so we'll now focus on the order from disorder phenomena. And the thing we'll be particularly interested in is this phenomenon first predicted by Schender in 1982, in which he predicted that quantum fluctuations will create a biquadratic term in the spin Hamiltonian. That's a pure quantum effect. And this K scales like 1 over S. So as S goes to infinity, this biquadratic term should go away. Okay. And the basic idea in the Schender mechanism is that quantum fluctuations promote collinearity. And the basic idea is that if you have one sublattice ordered and then you go to order the other sublattice, if you make them collinear, then you can take advantage of the zero-point fluctuations in both directions transverse to the ordering direction. Whereas if you made them perpendicular, you would be able to take advantage of the quantum zero-point energy in only one of the two directions. So this ends up producing an effective anisotropy, which manifests itself as a biquadratic term, which goes like 1 plus cosquared theta. So the effect of quantum fluctuations then is to produce collinearity. Let's see, no, I don't have the structure here. Okay. So actually, before we even knew about Schender's prediction, this is actually the only data that I personally produced, and this is before the high-flux beam reactor went down, and anything I've shown you just about are these red dots, which I happened to actually measure myself. Very early on, before we had even, you know, understood the physical system, we did not know about Schender's work at that time, we already knew that something interesting was happening, because, first of all, we measured the sublattice magnetization of the copper 1s. This system orders at about 100 degrees higher than the other typical systems, copper oxide systems. The reason is that in this case, the between plane coupling is not frustrated. So there's actually a relatively strong coupling between nearest neighbor planes of the copper oxide sheets. And so that promotes the ordering. It moves the ordering temperature up significantly, up to near 400 Kelvin. Then you look and you get this beautiful ordering, and this is an interesting general result, that the critical exponent for this is 0.28. It's actually very close to a quarter, and in which Michael, I'm not sure if you pointed out that that's the value you get at a tricritical point. And it turns out that this is essentially a universal result, which is that all quasi-2D systems with continuous symmetry exhibit a critical exponent beta of a quarter. And so do linear chain Heisenberg compounds in the order three-dimensionally. So there's a fluctuation-driven tricritical behavior in all 1 and 2D systems. And is there a theory for that, Amnon? Would you say?
No.
So we've spent, Amnon and I have known this for about 10 years, and have spent 10 years talking about it with each other. And we still don't have a theoretical understanding of why lower dimensional near Heisenberg systems exhibit tricritical behavior in the order parameter. Okay. But when we saw this, we said, okay, that's exactly what we expect. So then we cooled down to lower temperatures, and we looked at this order of the copper 2 system, and of course we expected to see the quarter, because that's what we've always measured in systems with continuous symmetry. The anisotropy, by the way, is such that this should asymptotically, in the absence of quantum fluctuations, would be a 2D XY model, okay, from the symmetry. I won't explain that to you. I mean, I won't give you the crystal field reasons for that, but that's the final answer. So this should have been a 2D XY phase transition, and we measured it, and it's actually just a magnificent 2D Ising model ordering. Okay. And this was very mysterious to us. And I remember actually when I finished the measurements, I immediately picked up the phone and called MIT and said to Mark Castor, guess what just happened, and this can't be, and et cetera. Okay, so this is a major shock to us at the time. Okay. That is, where does an Ising anisotropy come in the system that manifestly has continuous symmetry, that's manifesting an XY model? Okay. The next surprise came when we looked at the spin gap, out-of-plane spin gap, which is the XY gap of the copper 1. And that value in every single lanthanum copper, every single copper oxide material is 5 MeV, the gap, always. And no one knows why that's, well, there are some ideas, but it's surprising that it's so universal. So we looked in this material, we go down in temperature, and then sure enough, there it is at 5 MeV. And so there's the out-of-plane spin wave gap at 5 MeV, like in every other single copper oxide. We cool down further, and then suddenly to copper 2's order, and you see that the gap suddenly moves way up. And so the copper 1's then show this sudden sort of back effect from the copper 2's ordering. And if you use anisotropy language, it's as if the spin space anisotropy of the copper 2's went up by a factor of 4, of the copper 1's went up by a factor of 4 as a result of the ordering of the copper 2's, which is again, to us, was extraordinarily surprising. It turns out there's also a second mode, although, to be honest, at that time, when we did this, we didn't separate out the second mode, but it was only because later theory predicted the mode should be there, and we went back and looked very carefully and realized that the single mode we saw was actually two modes, which you do by varying the angular aspect, by taking advantage of the different polarizations of these two modes. Okay. Okay, so, and then also there's a lower mode down here, and it turns out that in addition there actually is a true Goldstone mode in the system at zero energy, which you don't see with neutrons, but you see with antifermionic resonance. Okay, so then at that stage we fortunately managed to persuade Amnon and Aura to get interested in this and to give us some help with it. I'm not going to dwell on this, but they took the simplest Hamiltonian you could, which is just a Heisenberg interaction on the two systems, the two systems separately, and an XY anisotropy term. In both cases, there's a small XY anisotropy. And then did the theory, but did it properly, including quantum fluctuations. Classically, what happens is that you just get spin waves separately for the two sublattices, right? And therefore you have separate sets of Goldstone modes. But then when you turn on the quantum fluctuation term, the Schender term, then it turns out that you then create a biquadratic term which crosstalks between the two. And so then you end up predicting altogether, since there are two copper ones, and one copper two per unit cell, you should have six modes at Q equals zero. Two are very high up in energy. And then you predict four low-lying modes, all four of which, in the absence of anisotropy or the Schneider mechanism, would be Goldstone modes. The XY anisotropy then raises two of the four modes up from zero. So you should then have two acoustic modes, two Goldstone modes, and then the Schneider mechanism, the quantum fluctuations, then break that degeneracy. Okay. And so that biquadratic term is measured by delta, okay, which you can then, if you know the J's, predict. Okay. So therefore, you predict a set of four low-lying modes, I repeat, all four of which would have been the Goldstone modes. Two get lifted by crystal field anisotropy, and one is a pure quantum effect, which would not happen classically. One gap. Okay. So if we now measure the dispersion in the C direction, then this is with only the copper ones ordered. And so this is the acoustic mode, or the Goldstone mode, of the copper ones. And that's the optical mode, which is the XY mode with the 5 MeV. Then we go below into the phase where the copper twos are ordered, which is this super lattice. You see, as a pure quantum effect, this Goldstone mode gets lifted from zero up to about 8 millielectron volts. So that's entirely order from disorder. And then this mode moves up further in energy up to about 10. Right? Then the modes from the copper twos appear, and we get the XY gap of the of one of the copper two modes, and then the true Goldstone mode down here of this coupled system. Okay, and the solid lines are just spin wave theory, including the effects of the quantum fluctuations, and with only, I think, essentially one new adjustable parameter, which we fitted, but which you can then estimate from first principles. Okay, and then there are two modes at very high energy. Okay, so actually, that's at the end of the story. I'm going to show you one more fancy quantum effect, which was predicted by one of the people in the audience, and which we confirmed. So I'm going to actually finish up shorter. So anyway, so just to summarize, so these are interpenetrating Heisenberg models, and you see now confirmed both in terms of the static effects, the effects on critical phenomena, and the effects on the dynamics of the raising of degeneracies of Goldstone modes. You see this sort of very beautiful quantitative example of quantum effects. So what I showed you in the first part of the talk is that quantum effects in two dimensions for the 2D Heisenberg model had only a quantitative, not a qualitative effect. That is that they renormalized rho s and therefore changed the temperature dependence, right? But ultimately you got classical critical behavior. In this case, the effect of quantum fluctuations, even though we're in two dimensions, is qualitative and not just quantitative, in the sense that it creates a biquadratic term which lifts degeneracies and removes Goldstone modes. Okay. Another quantitative effect, which was predicted in advance of these experiments by Rajiv Singh and co-workers, is that normally when you do spin wave theory, lowest order or second order even, then the spin wave quantum fluctuations renormalize the spin waves uniformly throughout the Brillouin zone. And they predicted, however, that this should not be the case in the two-dimensional Heisenberg model, and that the renormalization should be different in the 110 and the 100 directions. Because of the copper two system, because the energies are low, it means we could measure the spin waves quite precisely for the 2D Heisenberg model, which spin a half, which had not been done previously in a system which corresponds this well to the Heisenberg system. So these are the measurements, and this is just running along the zone boundary, right? Okay, so this is, I'm back to the zone center, pardon me, so this is running along the zone boundary, and in the nearest neighbor model, it should be flat, but Rajiv Singh predicted that, and co-workers, that in the nearest neighbor model, that the zone boundary energy at pi zero should be depressed by 7% relative to that at pi, and so that is the 7% reduction due to anisotropy in the effects of quantum fluctuations without adjustable parameter. Okay, and so this looks, I think, you know, like a real beautiful confirmation. There is a caveat in the logic, however, which I must point out, and the caveat is, this assumes nearest neighbors, which we actually don't know. So, of course, you could also fit these dispersion curves by putting in more distant neighbor interactions. We can't prove that that's incorrect, but you need fairly large interactions, and so it's unlikely. So it looks as if this is the right explanation. Okay. Okay, finally, let me just say, you can, of course, also, in this material, measure the spin correlation length as a function of temperature on the two sublattices separately, but no new physics emerged from that. We ended up just confirming what we had seen in all of the previous materials. Okay, so, actually, I don't have a summary view graph, but let me just say generally that, before the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity, there were no experiments in spin a half. None of these, this intellectual framework did not exist, and many of us believe that if you had a spin a half system, that you would go into some exotic new state of the sort that Phil Anderson had suggested. And then really as a result of a combination of experiments that we and everybody else involved in them are proud of, and I think some very beautiful theory, we now have actually a very sophisticated description of the quantum magnets in two dimensions. I would say from my point of view, I mean, given how this evolved historically, the one really major surprise was after this sort of great triumph with the quantum nonlinear signal model, I used to give a lot of talks in which inevitably people at the end of the talk would say, yes, but why does this work to such short length scales? And, I would say, give a theistic response, I guess, and call on God as an explanation. It turns out it was accident, which is probably not the same. Okay, thank you. Well, unless it was crystal. So the question is whether or not you need quantum fluctuations to lift that degeneracy. With the Hamiltonian we wrote down, the answer is yes.
So what would you have to invoke if you didn't have quantum mechanics? What would you have to invoke classically?
Then they just would be symmetry decoupled, and so they just would be truly independent systems.
Fluctuations will lift it. Also classical.
No, but that's at finite temperature.
Fluctuations on top of mean field.
The fluctuations will not lift it at T equals zero.
Not at T equals zero.
Right, at T equals zero.
Normal fluctuations will also
right.
do the job.
But not at T equals zero.
Dan, could you explain why there is this universal 5MeV spin gap?
So the question is, why is the spin gap always 5MeV? Again, Amnon and Ora looked at that. And to the extent that the anisotropy is dominated by the copper oxygen bonding in the plane, that's relatively invariant. And so even though the out of plane environment changes between all the different copper oxides, I guess the fact that it's a constant proves that the out of plane environment is unimportant in terms of determining the.
Why isn't it zero?
Because of spin orbit coupling.
In the plane.
Because of spin orbit coupling.
Spin
half? Yeah. Just small spin orbit coupling. There's a small effect of spin orbit coupling. So the G values are not exactly two, they deviate.
Yeah. A question about low temperature behavior in this system. Is it really a phase transition?
About
measurements like the specific heat or thermal expansion or whatever?
Which system?
Yeah, this one.
We measure the order parameter.
Both events are fine. I'm talking about both measurements. Specific heat, thermal expansion or whatever. Is it ordinary phase transition?
I guess my logic is different. If I want to know if it was an ordinary phase transition, I'd want to know what the order parameter does and what the critical fluctuations do. So that's the first question I would ask. That's been answered, so it is an ordinary phase transition with a divergent length. If you then want to say what are the thermodynamic properties which follow from that phase transition, the magnetization has been measured, some other things.
The implication extrapolating the scattering to zero angle is measured for susceptibility.
Right.
Yeah,
it is measured. So
I'm asking, maybe it's the question of Carter. Maybe there is some coupling, very weak, which make only one phase transition, but maybe there's some.
No, that's a very good question. I'm sorry. So you're right, it's a good question. They're symmetry decoupled, so there isn't a tail.
Please. There is another simplification of the one we have seen here for Brock, like, that there's 1 to 3 is for the game instead of Hebrew. There is also another successful system which orders transform metajoules into a separate lower density, and they are known to be coupled, although geometry is not allowed. So is there an experimental analogy between these two systems?
There may well be. I have not looked at that system, but that's a very good point. We should look back at it. Right.
Is the ground state generally set up the same way by quantum fluctuation and temperature fluctuation?
I don't know. What's the...
Yeah, finite temperature it was.
But it seems like physics may be different, because in one case, in quantum fluctuation, it's taking like the energy, sometimes more power, more understanding, and then it's going to take it like that. So in general, why is
I have a physics comment I want to make about quantum critical. Sure.
So moreover, refreshments in a moment is often going to make
right.
more comments.
Right. So, So for those of you who have been paying attention to some of the previous talks and to this one, you should now be very worried about any claim you've heard about quantum critical behavior in any physical system, if you think about it for about 2 minutes. Right, so what I just showed you is that for the quantum nonlinear theory model to get into the asymptotic regime, you have to get down to extraordinarily low temperatures, right? Which means even in the quantum critical regime, length scales would have to be quite large before you can talk about quantum critical behavior. And so far, no experimental system has gotten the length scale above a few lattice constants.
But there's the optimistic view that I think one has to say, that one of the nice things in magnetism, again, is that the leading order asymptotic seems to carry you further than it should. So, I mean, historically, even the series on the Ising model with seven-term series, you get the right exponents.
Right.
And this doesn't have to be the case.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think it's sometimes a little bit more than sheer luck.
Well, I showed you that for spin 5 halves, that statement turns out not to be true in this case. So I just said people should be cautious.
No, at a very high level of precision.
Yeah. Right. Okay. That's true. Anyway, so you know. Right. Right. So I think applying this talk of Marty Halpern-Nelson type phase diagram and statements about quantum critical behavior, et cetera, has to be done extremely cautiously because you've seen the historical development for the Heisenberg model. I just showed it to you.
So well, thank you, Stephen, again.